Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Top Civil War general and U.S. President Ulysses S. Grant is the face on the $50 bill. There's a move afoot to change that. North Carolina GOP Congressman Patrick McHenry is working to take President Grant off and put President Ronald Reagan on. Good idea? We'll go to the history. This hour on Point, Ulysses S. Grant and Ronald Reagan, who should be on the $50 bill. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Grover Norquist, who's all for Ronald Reagan on the 50. But first, joining me from Princeton, New Jersey, is Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton and author of The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and of The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. Sean Wilentz, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
So what did you first think when you heard this news that you've got a North Carolina congressman and, I don't know, 14, 15, 17 co-sponsors who would like to take Grant off, put Reagan on the 50?
I thought that Grover Norquist and his friends were really up to their business again. But seriously, I there have been a number of moves to honor the late President Reagan, many of which have been successful. But there seems to be a persisting urge to get him honored even more. So this is part of a longstanding effort by his political friends or people who think of themselves as his political friends to burnish his legacy in history. I just thought it's funny. I was asked to write about it with the expectation, since I'd written about Reagan and said many praiseworthy things about mm-hmm. Reagan, that I would support the idea. But the problem is that it's not just honoring Reagan, it's demoting U.S. Grant, who I think is probably the most underappreciated American president, perhaps the most underrated figure in all of American history.
Well, we'll have to look at that claim. I mean, if you go online to about.com, type in Ulysses S. Grant, and it comes straight up, Grant is considered to be one of the worst presidents in America's history.
Yes, he has been, and that in itself is a crime that that deserves investigation. But historians these days have been catching up to that, and there is a great revision underway. Word hasn't quite gotten out to the general public yet, not even to all the historians yet, but there is a reevaluation that's going on that's very, very important.
We'll go to that history and to Grant. I'm curious about the currency itself and how it gets decided who's where. I mean, of course,
yeah.
Washington on the one, Thomas Jefferson on the two, kind of an out-of-the-way place. Lincoln on the 5, Andrew Jackson on the Alexander Hamilton
on the
10, Andrew yeah. Jackson on the 20. Then we come to Grant on the 50. Of course, Benjamin Franklin, made famous in hip-hop music, on the 100. It's all about the Benjamins. William McKinley on the 500 and Grover Cleveland on the 1,000. And it goes right on up. I don't know how many of these bigger ones are even in currency at all anymore. There's a 5,000 with James Madison, the 10,000 with Salmon Chase, Treasury Secretary under Lincoln, the 100,000 with Woodrow Wilson. Maybe that's a place for Ronald Reagan. I don't know. But I wonder how he's decided who's on these.
You're not going to get a Princeton professor to say we should knock Woodrow Wilson off of anything.
Okay,
so anyway,
okay.
Go ahead.
Yes, I guess we won't. Take us back to Grant and the sort of course of the nation's understanding of this man from his appearance in the Civil War as a public figure, right on through these different waves that his legacy has lived through.
Right. Well, I mean, after the war, remember, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated on April 14th, just as the war was coming to a close. Mm-hmm. U.S. Grant was supposed to be there that night, actually, if his wife hadn't begged off. He might have been
in
that box at Ford's Theater. Mm-hmm. As it happened, he was on a train, and there was some mischief that was going on in the train, and there were some historians who think that there was an attempt to get at him anyway. But be that as it may, he emerged out of that as the great figure, the Union figure coming out of the Civil War. I mean, with Lincoln dead, Lincoln was the martyr. But he was the great defender, so he was the great general. And he was appointed, in fact, by Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, as general of the American armies, a sort of four-star general, the first in American history. Anyway,
I don't want to skip over the Civil War history before we get to the presidency, because He made such a name for himself there, Lincoln saying, I cannot spare this man. He fights. What was Grant's war record? I mean, even before that, I remember reading there was a book that came out on Vicksburg not long ago, reading about Grant, I think, grew up in pretty straitened circumstances in Ohio. And you've got Ohio Republicans now pushing back on this whole idea. But went to West Point, an incredible horseman. I read a story of him taking a party over the Isthmus of Panama before there was a canal where I think, I don't know, like a third of the people died. I mean, sort of young military heroics there. But he really came into fame and maybe in the eyes of the South, infamy in the Civil War itself.
Yeah, I mean, he came from nothing. Just before the war, he was in just reduced circumstances. He was making about, you know, $50 a month, rarely more than that. He was stopped by one of his old army buddies, and he said, what are you doing in here, Grant? And he said, I'm solving the problem of poverty. But then with the war, he ascended pretty quickly through the ranks, starting off as in Illinois. By then, he had moved up to Illinois and got up a company of volunteers for the war. He had been cashiered out of the army on account of an unfortunate incident about drunkenness, which we can talk about later. But in any case, he came back up. He found his way again. And by 1862, 1863, it's pretty clear that he is the kind of general that Lincoln needed very badly, one who actually fought. And it was under the plan, really, of Grant and Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman, and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, the policy of hard war to really make life miserable for the Confederacy. The Confederacy was not going to give up any other way. That the military fortunes turned really very late in what we now know was a four-year war, but only with the taking of Atlanta in September 1864 did it look as if the war was really going to turn around. Did it look like that Lincoln would even get reelected? But Grant was very much a part of all of that, and of course Grant accepted Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. So, you know, he's the great military Union military hero. He was even regarded, actually, at first as regarded with some respect by the South because of the terms upon which he accepted Lee's surrender. You know, soldiers were allowed to keep their horses, keep their sidearms, were allowed to go back to their farms. It was not a retributive kind of surrender. It was an unconditional surrender, but it was not one that was going to be mean or nasty. In fact, he first came to blows with Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, precisely over this point. Johnson, who very much hated the planter class and hated the Confederacy, he also didn't like the ex-slaves very much, but he wanted to bring up these guys, including Lee, on charges of treason, which would have been completely against what Grant's surrender terms had been. So Grant fought him very hard. And I think many in the South actually respected Grant for that, that he was thought of as a victor but as a magnanimous victor.
The contempt that he later came in for, you write, came in large part because of his Reconstruction policies when he took over the presidency.
I think that's right. Johnson, as president, had become very hostile to the freedmen, to freedmen's rights, really sided with the veterans of the Confederacy, the old leaders of the Confederacy.
Against ex-slaves.
Against ex-slaves and against Republicans who wanted to see Reconstruction really come to the South, to see a new biracial order to secure the rights that Congress had actually given to the freedmen under the Reconstruction Amendments. And Grant fought very hard to see all of that happen once he became president in 1868, he's elected president in 1868, to reverse Johnson's policies to prosecute a very vigorous Reconstruction policy in the South.
As a historian, how do you begin to weigh two presidents in such different times, almost a century apart, essentially, in the heart of their public lives? I mean, how do you begin that task?
Well, Tom, I'm not sure that that's really what's required here. I mean, it's not so much we're trying to say, or I don't think that it's a matter of saying who's better, you know, who's the better president.
Though that's being rolled out here. You know, people are comparing public popularity of Grant and Reagan, of where they rank in different scholarly rankings.
Yeah, I think that misses the point. I mean, if Grant was truly a disgrace, perhaps we could think of it that way. If something had been discovered that showed that he was a true disgrace in the presidency, that he oughtn't to have been there in the first place. I don't think that that's been claimed. And if it has been claimed, I think it's just dead wrong. It's a matter really of how do we honor a president we want to honor. And I think that there are plenty of ways to do that without displacing those we have already honored. That's the problem, it seems to me. It's less to do with honoring Reagan or comparing Reagan's accomplishments, which were considerable in my view, to those of U.S. Grant, but rather to say, look, do we honor him best by getting rid of a president from the currency? And that we haven't done before, and that wouldn't be a president now.
Of course, FDR made it onto a coin. JFK made it onto the half dollar. I guess mm-hmm. they weren't displacing figureheads in that case, right?
I think that's right. I mean, that's the point. It's part of my point. I mean, when Roosevelt was put on the dime in 1946, it was in part out of the nation's appreciation and grief at his death. He had been instrumental in getting the March of Dimes going, you know, for mm-hmm. polio research. So mm-hmm. there was a kind of justice in all of that. But, you know, the figure on the dime was the Mercury head. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't displacing a president or a figure, public figure. He was replacing an allegory. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem with that.
Sean Wilentz, please stand by. Professor of History at Princeton University. We're looking at U.S. Grant, Ronald Reagan, and whose face should be on the $50 bill. Here's a little bit of a Grant presidential campaign song from the Oscar Band. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
He will win election day as he holds our foes at bay, and we all will cheer to hear the happy news. He will oust the traitor horde with the ballot as his sword. The Ku Klux Klan will shiver in their shoes. Grant, 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 the country's calling. Goodbye, Andy, you must go. For the man will be our head, on to victory has led. For to Grant a traitor ever is a foe.
We're joined right now from Washington by Grover Norquist, President of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover Norquist, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
What's the case you would make for putting Ronald Reagan on the $50 bill, sir?
Well, I run an organization called the Reagan Legacy Project, which works on getting things named after President Reagan, just as people organized on behalf of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King to get things named after them to help secure their place in history. We've done the same thing, Reagan Airport here in D.C., and have supported for some time the idea of putting Reagan on the currency or on a coin. The rules allow President or Congress to do that. Actually, the Bureau of the Mint can do it. And I think that putting Reagan, originally we talked about getting him on half the dimes along with FDR. It's been discussed putting him on the 10 or the 20. Most recently, legislation has been introduced to put him on the 50. And what you do is not take Grant off the coins, but you'd move him up, as has been done in the past. Benjamin Franklin and Grover Cleveland have moved up as the years go by.
To a higher denomination note, you're saying?
Yeah. So you don't bump somebody off and not have it. You move people up into higher denominations. We could, with the inflation we've had and the inflation that's coming, $200 and $500 notes will not be rare.
Maybe not so obscure, maybe. Grover Cleveland on the 1,000 now. Make the case on its merits, though, for putting President Reagan on the more prominent $50 bill instead of U.S. Grant, Grover Norquist.
Oh, sure. Well, I'd make the case for Reagan up there with any of the presidents. When you look at what Reagan did when he came in 1980, all of the establishment was explaining the United States was in permanent decline. There were limits to growth. The presidency was too big for any one man. They wanted to have a committee to do it. The Soviet Union was on the march around the globe. They were running Afghanistan. They're making a play for Nicaragua, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia. Western Europe was being Finlandized by any measure. Over the previous 10 years, the West, the United States, the forces of liberty were getting weaker, and the forces of Soviet imperialism were getting stronger. They were taking more territory, building more weapons. Ronald Reagan turned that around, broke the back of the Soviet Union, stopped lending the money, cut off the flows of funds from Western Europe to Eastern Europe and to the Soviet Union, cutting off the resources that they needed. On the day that they had the coup, they were literally bankrupt. They had no Western currency, no hard currency in the Soviet Union. He did this without a lot of blood on the floor, without occupying Iraq or occupying Afghanistan or having hundreds of thousands dead or some big war, which makes the success all the more impressive and valuable. At the same time that he turned an economy that had been sliding, inflation at 10-11%, interest rates hitting 20%, and all heading in the wrong direction, when he came in, turned it around to where the American economy grew tremendously, created 20 million jobs during that period, and put us on a path that continued for quite some time until we had some subsequent presidents who reversed some of his tax policies and have brought us where we are today.
There's Grover Norquist, a great enthusiast of Ronald Reagan, with his case for him on the bill. Sean Valenti, you are our historian. You've written about Ronald Reagan. What do you make of the case we just heard?
Well, I wouldn't agree with every detail of what Grover Norquist just said, but I think Reagan was incontestably one of the great modern presidents. And, you know, we could end the debate right now if everybody concerned wanted to come up with a $200 note, which I don't believe exists, and put Ronald Reagan on that with the idea that inflation is indeed going to make money less valuable. I would have no objection to that.
But what about the case on history for our listeners who are listening closely here? Is it the case that Ronald Reagan bankrupted the Soviet Union? I mean, we've read more recently, I think, the CIA saying that their analyses were wrong, that the Soviet Union was kind of falling apart from the inside.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the Soviet Union was in much worse shape than American intelligence thought it was in. That, not to say that Ronald Reagan didn't do a lot. What Ronald Reagan did was to not listen to his conservative allies. I mean, at a time when George Will and others, a friend of mine, George Will and others were saying that Mikhail Gorbachev was just another Stalinist, when Howard Phillips of the Conservative Caucus called Ronald Reagan, the president, a useful idiot for the Kremlin. At that time, Reagan turned his back on those people.
To go ahead and talk with Gorbachev and open up those lines of communication.
Precisely, and to take the first important steps towards arms reductions and then towards ending the Cold War and giving Gorbachev enough credibility in his own corner to move ahead. I mean, he had people to fight against, as during the coup that Grover Norquist talked about. He was by no means a simple row to hoe. But nevertheless, he worked with Gorbachev to end the Cold War. That, I think, is one of the great accomplishments, perhaps the greatest accomplishment by any American president since World War II, and is deserving of our honor.
What happened during the 8 years of the Reagan period. When Gorbachev came in, his first reaction was to tell everybody to stop drinking, which is what all the Soviets do when they come in, and to send more troops to Afghanistan. The idea that his first effort was to try and get some sort of peace going. The Reagan people came in, and from the beginning, in their executive orders, they said, these guys in the East are living off of money being lent to them by bankers and by countries from the West. The West Germans were lending money to the East Germans to buy stuff from West Germany, which kept the regime afloat. They cut those funds off. The West Europeans, including Thatcher, wanted to build the two pipelines, which would have guaranteed the Soviet Union tens of billions of dollars every year in hard currency. We see now how a weak Russia manipulates those
pipelines through the Ukraine and so on.
Through the Ukraine. Well, it's a problem because it goes through an independent Ukraine now.
Right.
Back then, with only a Soviet Union and no Russia broken into little pieces, you would have had tremendous pressure on Western Europe.
Governor
Reagan stopped the second strand, delayed the first one. The Soviet Union was bankrupted when our friend Gorbachev was overthrown. And what the Reagan people said at the time and after was they needed to keep Gorbachev alive because he was continuing the policies that were destroying the Soviet Union. They feared his being overthrown, so they talked to him, but they didn't lend him money. They didn't do anything that would undermine the West's ability.
Governor, let me ask you, with all that, and I understand you're very a great admirer of Ronald Reagan, still there's a question here of whether to take U.S. Grant off the 50. You could demote him to some high bill so high we never see it, I suppose, but how do you look at that? I mean, I understand the way you see Ronald Reagan's accomplishments, and yet you could say Grant saved the Union itself. You don't hear people talking about moving George Washington off of the 1 or Abe Lincoln off the 5. Why demote Grant?
Well, I think Lincoln's decision saved the Union and kept it together. He'd have found a general who was willing to be as aggressive as Grant was. Grant was an aggressive general. Now, on the other hand, we had originally talked about moving Hamilton from the 20 off, and then we started to get...
You mean Jackson, Hamilton from the 10 off. Jackson on
I'm
the
sorry,
20, right?
Hamilton from the 10 mm-hmm. or Jackson from the 20 for mm-hmm. Reagan, and mm-hmm. frankly, I'd be just as happy with either of those. Hamilton was not a president, an important guy, did some interesting things at the Treasury Department, a hero from the Revolutionary War. Unlike Jefferson and others, he was there getting shot at, so he was a hero from the very beginning. And then, of course, Jackson is somebody who had a slight problem with property rights and wasn't very nice to Indians. So I don't know what Jackson's doing on. Even if you had to go for a blank spot, I might move Jackson.
Let's go to our listeners, Jay in Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, you're on the air. What do you think?
Thank you very much for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Jay.
Okay, thank you. I am against Ronald Reagan being placed on the $50 bill, and it's for three reasons primarily. The first being that it was under Ronald Reagan and his, treasurer, secretary, or who later went on to be his chief of staff, Don Regan. I just recently watched the movie by Michael Moore, Capitalism, A Love Story. We've had 30 years of this thing sold to us called trickle-down economics. And for those of us in the middle class and lower, you know, after 30 years of that trickle-down stuff, how you feeling, middle-class America? Secondly, when you talk about Ronald Reagan, it has been explained to me through interviews that I've heard on the point that Reagan's first term was much more different than his second term. And thirdly, when you talk about the fall of the Soviet Union, you all recently had on one of your programs a man who wrote the book about the Berlin Wall coming down. Ronald Reagan was a very small bit player in that entire process. And for 30 years, they've been trying to sell Ronald Reagan as the greatest thing since sliced bread. For those of us in the middle class, it just ain't so.
Jay, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. We'll go to it. Scott in Hilton Head, South Carolina. You're on the air, Scott.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, I mean, my alternative, I think the danger here, I don't like this business of replacing one person with another because I think it inevitably leads to rewriting history. I'm a Southerner, my whole family. I've got ancestors who fought in the Civil War, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to me, I think Grant ought to stay on the $50 bill. I don't think we ought to go there and start comparing who's a better president because you got different times, different situations. One of them's a war hero. One of them's a president. But, you know, to me, why not create a $25 bill, which is similar to what an individual said a little while ago while I was holding. I think he said a $200, but a $25 bill. I think Reagan's accomplishments are clear. I mean, he took a country that was in serious financial trouble through his own concepts of reducing capital gains, reducing income taxes. I mean, America went into 30 years of very, very serious prosperity and would have continued to, but that's a whole other issue with the banks. But anyway, I mean, you know, internationally, I mean, he was a man of conviction. He stuck to his guns. He put us in a different direction. He
so roll out a 25 for Reagan. We hear it, Scott, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and I'll go to our guest, Melissa Waltham, Massachusetts. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is just, why Ronald Reagan? I mean, there are lots of awesome presidents. T.R. knew how to stick to his guns.
Teddy Roosevelt, you know, okay.
You know, Truman, you know, had the famous, the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just... You know, why Ronald Reagan? Why now? Is there a particular reason for that?
Let's put it to Grover Norquist. What about it? There's Teddy Roosevelt, Grover. There's Harry Truman, Melissa says. You could go on down a list of great Americans.
Well, and I would argue that Ronald Reagan's accomplishments overwhelm those of both Teddy Roosevelt and Truman. Look, the nature of the Soviet Union was such a significant threat to the United States and the collapsing economy, none of the things that need... All of the lines were going in the wrong direction when Reagan came in, both unemployment, inflation, interest rates. He turned that around, gave us a strong economy, and created 20 million jobs. The fellow who says he's middle class and that talks about trickle-down economics, none of those 20 million jobs went to millionaires. Millionaires don't have jobs yet. New jobs are created for people who don't have jobs. So the idea that somehow this is only for rich people is kind of silly. And one of the reasons it's important to put Reagan on, I'll go for the 10, the 20, or the 50. This is not against some other president, except people who've been there for a long time. Maybe it's time to move them on and up. But the argument for Reagan is partially so that people are not allowed to rewrite history and quote Michael Moore movies as a reason for their understanding of what Ronald Reagan created.
Sean Walensky, if I may, each of these American figures had their scandals. You know, Grant had plenty. Ronald Reagan had the Iran-Contra. You know, people will look to those. On that front, you know, which has the more bruises to deal with?
They both had bruises. I mean, the Reagan administration had plenty of indictments, not just Iran-Contra, which was a constitutional question about which I suspect Grover Norquist and I would disagree profoundly. But be that as it may, you had the SNL problems and with not so much who did them, but the deregulation questions about that, the looting of housing and urban development, the WedTech scandal, which ended up in basically in Edwin Meese having to resign. There are scandals, particularly in second terms.
And Grant's?
Well, Grant had two big ones on his watch in the second term. He was kind of blamed for the Crédit Mobilier scandal, which actually occurred before he was president. Basically, a railroad company was bribing congressmen, but that happened before his watch. But it was announced while he was president, so he gets tarred with that brush. There were two others, the whiskey scandal and the Belknap scandals, neither of which he was directly implicated in or even secondarily implicated in. He did help his friend Orville Babcock, who is his personal secretary, who was implicated in the whiskey scandals. He was not in anywhere near as involved. Grant was never directly implicated in any of those scandals. I think if we start heaping up scandals, look, Tom, the only two demigods among the American presidents, I think, and I think Grover's actually mentioned them, is or George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Rightly or wrongly, they are thought of as supremely our great presidents. Mm-hmm. Everyone else, you're going to have flaws. You're going to have drawbacks. I would disagree with the caller who said that Ronald Reagan was just a bit player in winning the Cold War. I think he was much more than that, and I do think he deserves to be honored. But hey, $25 bill, that's fine with me. $200 bill, fine with me.
Grover Norquist, I've just got you for another minute. What do you think the odds are of this happening? And what else do you have your eye on for honoring President Reagan?
Well, I think it will happen to have him on a coin or a bill. It's a question of time. I think it was it reflected very badly on George W. Bush that he didn't do it when Reagan passed away. That would have been the appropriate time to have done it. He had the authority to do it. And I never got a honorable reason given me as to why they didn't move then. But over time, I think, as we've learned more about Reagan and how actually the letters he wrote and how much he was on top of things in these issues, which is exactly the opposite of what I was told by the establishment when he was president, that the Reagan, the Book of Life and Letters, the collection of his writings, the fact that he wrote all of his own, that is, his own speeches and radio talk shows for a decade, radio presentations for a decade, the depth of the man gets deeper. And as we learn more from the Soviet Union and the bowels of the Eastern Bloc secret police records, the role he played in actually bringing down the Soviet Empire, I think will make him stronger and stronger. Now, other things, they're talking about a mountain in Nevada. They're talking about a mountain range in Alaska. Most states are looking at doing something. There are a few Democratic senators who refuse to do a Reagan Day on his birthday, but most do, Republicans and Democrats.
Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform, pushing for Reagan on the 50. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We heard a little bit of Grant's campaign song there reenacted. We don't have him on tape. We do have Ronald Reagan. Here he is at the 1984 Republican National Convention in Dallas, making the case that his leadership had turned the nation's spirits around.
Worst of all, Americans were losing the confidence and optimism about the future that has made us unique in the world. Parents were beginning to doubt that their children would have the better life that has been the dream of every American generation. We can all be proud that pessimism is ended. America is coming back and is more confident than ever about the future.
Ronald Reagan, 1984. Sean Nolens, we've got a lot of response to this online here. Web comments saying, I'm okay. This is Mike says, I'm okay with putting Reagan on the 50 if we can put Clinton on the 20. Once you start, where do you go? Here's Evan saying, America hung in the balance during the Civil War and Grant led us to victory. How can we forget about that effort for our country? Here's Jim who says, this seems like an attempt by a Southern senator, it's a congressman actually, to diminish the accomplishments of a Union general. And here's one from Ken saying, yeah, wait 100 years, then decide. Let's go to Fort Mill, South Carolina. And Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I am someone who actually worked with Ronald Reagan in 1976 and in 1980, literally on the bus, in the hallways, in the elevators, in the wings.
On his presidential campaigns, okay.
On his presidential campaign, starting as a senior in high school. And I can tell you unequivocally that Ronald Reagan would find this to be the silliest thing. He wouldn't want himself on a bill. He was a very humble human being, and I think that's why people are so fond of Ronald Reagan. And I like that clip that you played earlier, because really that's essentially the legacy of Reagan, a very optimistic person. Unfortunately, I don't get to see enough of Grant's stay in my wallet.
Me either.
Grant, you know, most people forget that Grant, you know, in 1871 passed and signed a sweeping civil rights legislation for public accommodations. Unfortunately, it was overturned by the Supreme Court a few years later, 8-1. So I think Grant's legacy will always stick with us. Plus, he was a hero and he saved the nation, and Reagan stands for itself. But Tip O'Neill, one of Reagan's great friends and a great Speaker of the House, said all politics is local. And really, Patrick McHenry, who is just a few miles away from where I live.
Mm-hmm. The North Carolina Republican who's sponsoring this, yeah.
Tough re-election race with moderate Republicans, or what, well, I guess moderate in this area,
yeah.
Who think that Mr. McHenry has aligned himself with the Washington right-wing crowd. And no offense to Mr. Norquist, but I knew he couldn't miss an opportunity to take swipes at people like Thomas Jefferson, and that's why I think Ronald Reagan would want nothing to do with this.
Jim, thank you very much. I really appreciate
Tom,
that call. Yes, Sean.
Can I jump in here? Mm-hmm. I think Jim really hit it on the head about Reagan, which is that part of Reagan's charm and part of Reagan's power, really, as a political figure, was his modesty. He was a patriot. He thought of himself that way. Now, there are plenty of people who disagree, but I think that in terms of temperament, you know, Grant lived for a brief time in Illinois, and Ronald Reagan was born in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And I think that Ronald Reagan would have thought it would have been a terrible thing for him to displace another president who had something to do with Illinois. Mm. And that was very much his spirit. So I think Jim really nailed it.
What about, I wish you'd expand on the civil rights efforts of Grant. I mean, you made some reference to them here, but our caller, Jim, speaks more to it. Give us a sense of what Grant was up against and what he did on that front.
Well, he was up against the Ku Klux Klan, among other things. He was up against a spirited terrorist campaign to undo what was going on in Washington in terms of expanding and securing the ex-slaves' rights. That began with the 15th Amendment, which he mentioned in his inaugural address, Grant did. We pushed for very hard, which guaranteed the right to vote for men regardless of color and previous condition of servitude. And that was just the beginning. But the diehard Southerners fought back, and they fought back violently. And to the point where early 1870s, Congress had to pass enforcement acts and actually bring private crimes into the federal realm, which was really something quite unprecedented. And with the third of those enforcement acts, the Ku Klux Klan Act, President Grant basically destroyed the Ku Klux Klan by the end of 1872. Now, things went the other direction thereafter. The Southerners, the diehards, refused to quit. But for a short period in there, one saw the beginnings of precisely the kind of egalitarian possibilities of blacks and whites working side by side, blacks getting jobs, blacks getting elected, blacks voting, all of that. None of that would have been possible without Grant. A lot happened on the ground. A lot of people deserve a lot of credit. A lot of people were very courageous. But without Grant, it wouldn't have happened. Then there was a continued backlash, and Reconstruction eventually did come to an end.
What happened to Grant's reputation there that's left him, as I said earlier, go to about.com on the Internet, and he's called just flat out, considered to be one of the worst presidents in America's history. How did that come to pass as his legacy?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, you see this great tomb in New York, this great memorial to him, mm-hmm. and people wonder, what is that all about? And the fact was that when Grant died, he was still considered a great man, the most admired living American. It was only after that, he died in 1885, that monument remained popular into the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. It was only after that that his reputation really began to plummet. And it occurred because of two basic forces. One was Southern historians began to rewrite the history of the Civil War in terms much more sympathetic to the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee became the great military hero of the war. It's rare that the loser actually becomes the great military hero, but nevertheless, that's what happened. And Grant was vilified as a butcher, a person who was simply willing to let people die in order to win his battles, which is a misreading of the evidence. But Grant during Reconstruction was thought by many of the same historians to be promoting what one called, with a complete lack of tact, the blackout of honest government. Basically, these were Southerners who did not like the idea of blacks getting the kinds of civil rights that Grant wanted them to get. So they rewrote him out of history. They were helped along with a certain group called the Liberal Republicans, Northern, bien pensant, people who were very high-minded, people like Henry Adams, who thought that Grant should never have been president in the first place. Then in the 30s and 40s, 1930s and 1940s, amid the Depression, another whole segment of the historical profession, the more the left wing of the historical profession, didn't think Grant was so bad during the Civil War, but continued to harp on his on the scandals and made him out to be a kind of, emblem
gilded
of the
age,
gilded
monster
age.
There.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is, of course, that Grant's best friend was Mark Twain at the end of his life, the man who actually came up with the name for the Gilded Age and was a satirist and was very, very funny about all of that.
Wow.
But in any case, and then thereafter in the 60s and 70s, there was a continued attack on Grant. Even as the old Southern Southern school was overturned, Grant continued to be vilified as a person who didn't do enough for the freedmen. There was a view that Reconstruction had been a failure. All of that has now been challenged. All of that is now going by the board, and I think that finally Ulysses S. Grant is going to get his due.
Now, what about turning to the history when it comes to civil rights and Ronald Reagan?
Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan's, yeah.
Oh, I'm getting people, writing in online saying, hey, what about Reagan and his famous states' rights speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the way he campaigned, how he campaigned on with race as a backdrop?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that Reagan played on the Southern strategy that had begun really with Goldwater, but with Richard Nixon in particular. He did give his first important speech after the convention in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, a site where three civil rights workers were murdered in 1964. That couldn't have just been a coincidence. Reagan kind of winked at the segregationists or the diehard segregationists in the South. There was one point when he was asked whether Martin Luther King was a communist, and he said, well, we'll just have to wait and see what the verdict of history is. Later, he changed his tune about King, to be fair, and I think signed the legislation, in fact, for Martin Luther King Day. And Reagan himself, in the things that I've read, was, not a particularly racist kind of guy. I mean, mm-hmm. depending on how you define that term, he was by no means a Jim Crow type, although he did, when he was younger, sign a covenant, one of the Jim Crow covenants out in California. But, I don't think he was evil on that score. I just think that his policies were not very good. His positions weren't very good during his campaigns. And then after he got to be president, the Civil Rights Division under his presidency was more dedicated to rolling back advances that had been made in the civil rights area rather than pushing them forward.
We're looking at Grant versus Reagan on the $50 bill. Let's go to our callers. Fort Myers, Florida. Marcus, you're on the air, Marcus.
Hey, Tom, I'm a lifelong Republican. I voted for President Reagan twice. But with the scandals and the
questions about him even being lucid and coherent at the end of his presidency, the trickle-down theory, like your earlier caller said, paying millionaires first, hoping they spread it around. I understand your earlier guest is a paid lobbyist, and he's paid to get President Reagan on everything possible, but the most important...
I think he's more an enthusiast than a lobbyist, but I take your point. I agree.
But I think that the most important aspect is the stability of our currency. When we recently put out the new uncounterfeitable versions of the bills, it was a bit unnerving for some people. If the whole point of our currency is for economic stability, let's keep the symbolism strong on our bills at a starting point. And right now, it's just not a good time to change our money's face. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. Keep it simple. Keep it familiar there, I guess. Robert, thank you very much for your call. Robert in Olmstedville, New York. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, I can't believe that we're considering a president. Look, he promised to cut spending, all right? When he left office, the national debt was triple what it was when he entered.
You're talking about President Reagan here.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, we also had the Iran-Contra, the Ali North business. The Soviet Union was collapsing well before his term of office. He was brutally anti-union, considering the air traffic controllers and so forth. Anti-environment. The last year in office, he was basically senile. Supply economics.
You can't hold that against him. I mean, if that was the case, right? It just doesn't seem fair to hold that against a man. He was wrestling ultimately.
Okay, but I think it was dangerous the last year in office. But I'm sure there were other people controlling things. His apocryphal stories of black welfare people driving around in Cadillacs, which were shown to be simply made up stories, simply to move to prove a point. Europe considered him an embarrassment. The Beirut massacre, where 287 Marines were killed.
We've got your take on the Reagan legacy, and I appreciate it, Robert. Let's get one more here. Elena, Norfolk, Virginia. Elena, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. This is a great program. Thank you for this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that in the past, maybe when we didn't have the opportunity to have a full and abiding understanding of what these men represented, we could slip and have certain things pass. But at this point, we need to look at the full picture, and we have good information to have a good picture of what this man has represented.
So who does that leave you supporting, Elena? Reagan or Grant?
I'm supporting it. I'm totally mm-hmm. against it. I feel that all the negatives go along with it, and what he represents ultimately and unfortunately is a group of people who seem to have a deep and abiding commitment to unfair advantage and consequently inequality and injustice.
Are you talking about President Reagan here?
That.
Are you talking about President Reagan?
Yes, I am. Absolutely.
We got it, and I appreciate that. Let me get one more. Michael in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Michael.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I love your show, and I waited half an hour to get my point in.
Sorry.
I personally was aghast when I heard of this, because I think I'm not alone. But probably about half the population of the country, when they were around, I'm in my mid-40s, and we saw him as a joke and a scary one, too. I mean, we were afraid that he was going to start a war. And then I heard Bill Moyer say yesterday how basically when Reagan came in, executives were making about 35 times their average salaried employee in their companies. Now it's 350. And it all started with him and everybody, all the upper middle class selling out, trading up, everything becoming more expensive. I lived through that as a college age and beyond, and I saw what was happening. And I'm shocked. I wouldn't even use a $50 bill if I saw his face on it.
Michael, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Sean Wilentz, it's really interesting. At the end of this debate, it turns toward the economic legacy of Ronald Reagan. And for a rather long while, it was pretty well conceded that it was pretty great. The latest meltdown has got some people looking back at that now and saying, what got us on this path? How does a historian weigh an economic legacy of a president?
Well, I mean, Ronald Reagan changed the terms in which we the government acts inside the economy. The deregulation, but also the tax system. I mean, when he came into office, the top marginal rate was 70%. We're not going to see top marginal rates at 70% anytime in my lifetime, or those of the listeners, I think, even the youngest. So the basis for the kinds of social supports, which include everything from infrastructure on to the military, that basis was changed radically. People think of Reagan as a conservative. In fact, he was a radical in many ways, if not in demeanor, at least in his policies. So the economic shift was real. Inequality did indeed increase under his watch, and it continued to increase until the Clinton administration, in fact, when it came down. So I don't think that there's an economic reason or economic policy is a strong reason to give for putting Reagan on the on any kind of bill. There is a way in which you can say that money became worth less, so I suppose you could put him on a really big bill, and there'd be some poetic justice in that. But, you know, I see his accomplishments basically in foreign policy, and they were real, and, you know, they're worth consideration.
Professor, if you had to bet a 50, 5 years out, whose face on the new $50 bills?
Oh, I say U.S. Grant, without question.
Well, time and history will tell. Sean Wilentz, professor at Princeton University. It's great having you. Thank you so much for your time today, Sean.
Thank you, Tom. It was a real delight.
Sean Wilentz, author of The Age of Reagan and the Rise of American Democracy. Listeners, thanks for your thoughts and calls in this hour as well. It's always great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.